part travel writing, part memoir. There's a lot of that sort of book around, but Alaska's Bill Strever has carved out a best-selling niche by combining those elements with science. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Bill Strever is here to talk about his new book, Heat. Yes, his last book was called Cold. Statewide phone number 1-800-478-8255. 478-TALK, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Bill Strever returns today to Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Heat. Adventures in the World's Fiery Places. Bill Strever. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you on. It's been a long time since you were on before, and you got another book out.
Well, that's right. It's been a long time, but also a short time. It just, the months pass by like lightning.
Yeah, well, you get to do a lot of traveling.
I do a lot of traveling. That's true. That's now, absolutely true.
Now, how do you manage that?
How do I manage it?
I can't imagine your publisher is exactly buying all those plane tickets and everything and making that massive carbon footprint that you've been laying out.
That's right. That's right. That's absolutely true. So I have a day job, like many writers, and in my day job, I travel most often to meetings, but sometimes out to do field work. And when I'm traveling, I'll take a few days off here and a few days off there. And also, I have family scattered to the winds, so there's family visits, and there's also just trips for the sake of taking trips.
So you plan it out, basically.
You plan it out, but, you know, topics like cold and heat, they're such broad topics that you could almost go anywhere. I remember when I was writing Cold, and I was in the tropics, and I thought, well, what can I write about cold in the tropics? And I was there on a diving trip because I'm an avid diver, love to dive. And I was in the Philippines, and I thought, well, what can I write about cold in this climate? But in fact, there were things to write about cold sitting there very close to the equator.
I don't know if the writer knows or is aware of the kind of voice that they would have and how it appears. I know as a broadcaster, it's hard for me to know how a listener is relating to me. Who the picture they have in their heads and like that. But the picture I get of you is this sort of innocent, as much as you are always, you know, wanting to explore things and have done all this traveling and researched all this history and so forth, I also, at the heart of it, see you as kind of this innocent being that is willing to be impressed by all this cool stuff that you're experiencing.
You've made my day. That's a great compliment. I wouldn't say that I intentionally try to create that persona, but that is sort of who I am. You know, I'm always delighted when I see something new. And in some ways, that aspect of my personality is what drove me to write Cold and Heat, because you think about a topic like heat and your day-to-day life, you're around heat. Even here in Alaska in the middle of winter, you've got your wood stove going or your radiant heat going, so something to make you warm. So you're thinking about heat, or you're putting on a coat, you're thinking about heat. But you don't think about it because you've got a filter on. So you're filtering all that out. And writing a book like Heat, I can peel that filter away and I can take delight in things that are normally just ignored or completely taken for granted. And to me, that's really important.
That's a fascinating approach.
Well, again, thanks. You know, it's going back to this idea of a persona, and you're right, you do, as a writer, you do project a persona. A lot of my friends say when they're reading Heat and when they read Cold, they're calling me up and they're saying things like, it's just like you're sitting here talking to me.
I think that's because of the sense of irony.
Maybe.
Because you don't hesitate to, Woody Guthrie will do this too in his song lyrics. You just, you know, it's sort of going along with the story, and then there's an observation, you know. And we laid out a carbon footprint of something.
That's right. And you kind of you weave those things together. And,
right.
And, of course, yeah. some of that is very carefully planned, or at least planned through the revision process, where you're bringing inserting a story or an anecdote or a fact into just the right place as part of another story, part of a bigger issue.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would call them metaphors. I mean, more, I think, in heat than in cold, you're consciously exploring a metaphor, which is what an artist will often do. Whereas, here you are doing the monotonous, busy work of making art, right? And you have to have something in your head. And so whatever it is, it's, you know, it could be like butterflies, or butterflies changing in the climate, or something. Not necessarily reasonable, but it's a thing that you're exploring many, many different facets and dimensions of, and that's what you're doing with heat. And then you say, well, let's just make it simple here. Let's see how hot can we get to, and can I touch it?
Yeah, can I touch it? That was always one for me. How close can I get without hurting myself too badly? That's right.
Well, it is. It is, and it's very much in cold, you know, where you expose yourself to hypothermia. Okay. Am I getting stupid yet? Am I getting irrational?
Some would say I was stupid and irrational before I got in the water, but...
Definitely not risk-averse.
No, I'm not. You know, and I get that question a lot. It seems like you do really dangerous things. Most of them aren't truly dangerous. I mean, if something went wrong, yeah, I mean, possibly you could be hurt. But, you know, most of the things I'm doing aren't stunts. I wouldn't call them stunts. I'm not taking high risks. I'm doing things that... to satisfy my curiosity that maybe it'll be a little inconvenient, maybe it'll be a little painful, but probably aren't truly dangerous.
For some reason, Chris McCandless pops into my head as somebody that didn't know how to exercise due prudence. That always gets phone calls. The telephone number, by the way, is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage, 550-8422. Email talk at alaskapublic.org. We're talking with Bill Strever, Alaskan author of the new book, Heat, Adventures in the World's Fiery Places, in which he goes to the world's fiery places, including a nuclear accelerator. I guess not the hottest one, right? There's a hotter one in Europe someplace?
There is now. At the time I was working on the book, which wasn't long ago, the one in Brookhaven, New York, was the most powerful and largest.
And hottest.
Hottest because of the experiments they did. But you need the power. So the bigger an accelerator is, the bigger a collider is, the more powerful it is, and therefore you can create collisions that have more energy and create more heat.
So then basically, this is pre-Higgs boson. It's already obsolete.
It's already obsolete, that's right. You know, and that's one of the difficulties, writing a book like Heat. If you write about things like climate change or about colliders, super colliders, before it gets in print, it takes a long time to go from your keyboard to in print in book form. It takes a long time, and the world changes around you.
Well, I say you're really lucky you didn't have to explain the Higgs boson.
Well, that's true, and you'll notice in here I didn't pretend to be a particle physicist. I did talk to an amazing particle physicist for a day. Barbara Jacek showed me around the collider in Brookhaven, and actually took me down into the tunnels where the action was going on, where they were colliding the nuclei of gold atoms together at very close speed.
Not at the moment when you were there.
No, you can't be in the tunnel when the experiments are going on. It was down for between experiments. And you know, an interesting thing, the difference between the collider in Europe, the new collider that's created these even hotter temperatures, I think 10 trillion Fahrenheit, the difference between that collider, among the differences, is that they're using lead ions instead of gold ions in their experiments.
I'm still getting over the 10 trillion.
Big number, isn't it? Hard to imagine.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, and
How many new colors would Australia have to put on their weather map to get to that?
I'm just kidding.
And it goes much hotter. The universe gets much hotter. We know that. We don't know how hot the universe can be, but we know it's much hotter than 7 trillion that was done in New York or 10 trillion that was done in Europe. We also know that Fahrenheit is sort of an odd unit to use when you're talking about temperatures that hot, but so be it. It's what we're used to.
Oh, that's what all those scientists say.
That's right.
But I kind of like it, you know. I kind of like it. So have you ever been, I might have lied about you because I said he's been on the North Slope when it was too cold to fly.
I saw that and I was trying to think where that might have come from. I certainly couldn't fly. usually planes fly better in colder air because it's more dense. But
until it gets to like 30 below or so, and then I think 50 below is the cutoff.
Is that right? I haven't heard that before.
Yeah. Well, for commercial flights, for you know, air taxis and like that. Yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah. which probably has to do with keeping their engines running more than with the flying itself, but I don't really know.
I don't usually admit to my BS there, but I didn't fact check that.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, how you doing? What are you going to do when you get done with this promoting this thing?
Well, you know, a couple things. One, I'm hoping to do a lot more sailing. My wife and I are in the process of moving on to a boat in the next year to 2 years. So we're slowly downsizing our house and moving into a new adventure and one that doesn't have quite the carbon footprint that all this air travel
takes. Why am I guessing this boat is not in Whittier?
It is not in Whittier, but you know what? Guess what? It is registered in Whittier. It's a Coast Guard registered vessel, registered out of Whittier because we spend so much time down there diving.
Out of Whittier.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, but in addition, I am working on another book, and the new book is called Gold, and it's about all things gold.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So gold mining, gold investing, the gold standard, which was invented by Isaac Newton, of all people.
Wow. So you're already deep in your research.
Fairly deep in the research, deep in the research of mining. Actually, really, just at the beginning of the research would be more accurate because there's a long road ahead. It'll be 2 or 3 years before that book's finished.
I went to one of the gold mines in Kolyma, in the Kolyma River in the Russian Far East, which was then the Soviet Far East, and it was a press tour. And we got to go down into the mine, and they did a white quartz with the gold veins. You got to see the gold veins in the white quartz.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm envious.
And then they had a safe with the gold in it. They opened it up, said, oh, there it is. There's the gold. They closed it up.
Yeah. So was that mine deep enough that it was warm in the tunnels?
You know, I wish I would have been aware that it's possible to get deep enough into the earth to feel its heat, because I didn't know.
Oh, yeah, it's not only possible.
I only learned that in this book here, Heat, yeah. Adventures in the World's Fiery Places by Bill Strever. Telephone number 1-800-478-8255. Yeah.
It's not only possible, it's common. Lots of mines in the world now, one of their biggest challenges is dealing with the heat for their workers.
Well, and I was talking to a plumbing guy, and he was saying there's still engineers that don't believe that coal goes down. But it does.
That cold goes down.
Cold goes down into the ground. So in the early part of the winter, it's not as deep as it is later on.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Depending on where you are. Of course, cold goes up, too. If you're in a frozen landscape, like say, the Arctic, the ground is frozen below sort of 10 or 15 inches down. Uh-huh. The ground is frozen in late summer. And then winter comes, and the ground is cooling from above, but it's also cooling from below, so it's squeezing that area of thawed out soil.
Squeezing. But what about the earth warming it up from underneath?
Well, further down and way down in the permafrost, so say in the northernmost parts of Alaska, it might be 1,800 feet.
Well, that's not very far.
It's not very far, but in the earth below the 1,800-foot level, the earth is warming up that permafrost.
Wow.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for that.
So warmth and cold, hand in hand all over the planet.
All right, now, there's a moment in this book where it was fairly unforgettable, where you, and I think it illustrates your assertion that you exercise due prudence. You and your companion are have a fever, a little ill, and you're up in a little higher elevation there around the volcano house someplace up there in Volcano National Park or around it.
Close to it, yeah.
And so you sort of take a slow approach with your hikes and all that, as opposed to your usual direct approach to the molten lava. But there does come a molten lava point. And what sticks in my mind is you wanted to touch this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Which you didn't quite do. So tell me what you did.
I'm not sure which part you're thinking about. There were a couple places where caution overcame my curiosity. Curious George took a backseat to caution for a couple of moments, and one of my favorites is because of the way it played out. I was seriously considering trespassing into part of the park that was closed. And I was working with a geologist who worked for the park, and he'd spent hours and hours with me over a period of days showing me around, helping to educate me about volcanoes and about lava. And we went out to dinner, and I was telling my companion, who's also my wife, okay, when we're done here, we're going to sneak in the back way and go check out some of this lava. And we were actually on the way there when this geologist telephoned me, and he said, you know, I don't think you would do this, but I hope you're not thinking of trespassing, because you really don't want to do that. It is patrolled, and plus it would be stupid because there's sort of sulfuric acid in the air and whatnot.
So tactful.
Yeah. I just thought that was great. He had totally nailed me. I hadn't mentioned anything to him about the thought that I was going to do this.
Oh, just in case.
Figured out exactly what I was going to do. Yeah. Yeah, and then eventually we did get up on the mountain into flowing lava, and Harry Houdini used to talk about immersing his hand in molten lead, and supposedly you can do this, and I've read about it, and there's a physical phenomenon that supposedly would allow you to do this and not be badly burned, and I didn't try it, so another piece of caution. And when I got to flowing lava, I also didn't touch the lava, but I did run a hammer through the lava, so I could feel the viscosity of the lava, which is... You know, you can say it feels like this or it feels like that. It feels like molasses, but really, it feels like nothing else I've ever quite felt. Just to move a hammer, a geologist's hammer, through the lava, the thickness of the lava, the temperature right there.
Was it moving? The lava, was it flowing?
It was flowing, yeah.
And so, could you feel it like the current, like you would feel if you dipped something in a stream?
Only if you had you can't, because it's flowing. The lava in Hawaii is a very, very slow.
So all the resistance, it probably presented some resistance to this hammer as you...
Well, more when I moved the hammer sideways through the lava, you could kind of feel it. It's thick stuff. I mean, it's rock. It's molten rock.
Sure is.
Yeah.
So you got hot while you were doing this, I would think.
We got hot. We took some walks across the lava just after it had hardened, following this geologist.
Now, see, that's what I heard was the dangerous part, because you'd just fall through.
Well, that's what you would think, but it hardens quicker than you would imagine, and it's sort of like walking on a lake, right, when a lake doesn't have to have very much ice.
That's how they scared me. That's how the rangers scared me when, I wanted to go trespassing. They said, you get on top of that stuff, and it looks like it's solid, and you step on it, you go swoosh.
Yeah, well, that can't happen. I mean, it's definitely not a recommended thing to do, but I was there with a geologist who was very familiar with the terrain and the situation, and... At first, I, like you, I said, I think I'm going to walk around, but he was moving too fast, and I didn't have time to keep walking around, so I started following him, and I had a walking stick with me. And he said, I love this, he said, keep moving so your boots don't melt.
Right.
And which is also sort of a trick to fire walking in bare feet, but I had a walking stick with me, and I'm walking along, and the walking stick had one of these rubberized plastic tips on it, and the tip of the walking
stick...
and the tip of the walking stick burst into flames, and I sort of beat it out against the lava and kept walking, thinking, this is an interesting situation.
Well, I don't know. It's not quite Jackass, but it's a little bit in that direction here, Bill Strever, I have to say. Put your own body at peril, and another one that comes to mind, and I guess it relates to heat. You put it in the book, and that is energy and crude oil and all that. So you go to Petrolia, what they used to call Petrolia, part of Pennsylvania there, mm-hmm. where they first commercialized crude oil. And because you saw that it was once marketed as a patent medicine, nothing would do but what you had to taste some.
Who would not have done that? So that's right. So the story is, well, first of all, heat is about lots of different things.
I'm looking
hot.
At your son here, and he gets his jaws dropping.
Yeah, I think
he must have heard these stories before, or do you not? Do you sheltering him?
He's definitely not a sheltered child.
Oh, okay.
I think he may have been there at least one time when I tasted oil, but...
There's more than one.
You have to do taste comparisons. So the book has...
You're killing me.
Well, the book has some chapters about fuel, and we've gone through different kinds of fuel and eventually get up to oil, which is the fuel we're still largely dependent on as a society. And one of the things I found out was that people were drilling for salt. Western Pennsylvania, they were drilling for salt, and oil was coming up with the salt and ruining the salt wells, and they were throwing the oil away. No one knew what to do with this nasty black stuff, except one guy named Samuel Keir, who said, hey, I'm going to bottle this stuff up and sell it as medicine, and I found a number of his old advertisements. And he was quite successful selling this as medicine, and I read these ads, and I thought, well, this is interesting. And the Curious George part of my personality won out over the cautious part of my personality. I said, I'm going to try a spoonful of this, and I tried it, and it was every bit as good as you might imagine.
Something tells me you've already tasted whale, probably seal oil.
I have, yeah. I have.
So does it have a similar lingering effect?
Well, you know, whale oil, different whales have, the oil has different tastes, so it depends
there
on which.
There you go again.
Sorry. Yeah, so it depends on the whale oil and also how old it is and how it's prepared. But I don't think I've ever come to any whale meat or whale oil that came close to the nastiness of rock oil or crude oil.
Yeah.
I wouldn't
call it nasty, but it's something about the fats stays in your system, and you taste it a long time afterwards.
In whale oil.
Yeah.
Yeah, in crude oil, it is. I think most people who have tasted it, the limited club, I think would probably describe it as a pretty nasty taste, and you still taste it the next day. I mean, it doesn't go away.
Oh.
It's with you for a while.
Were there, you didn't mention in the book, but being who I am, I have to ask, were there after effects digestively speaking?
No, I didn't. Nothing
really?
That I noticed. No, but remember, I only took a spoonful. And back in the day, the recommended dose was 3 spoonfuls a day, one with each meal. So you might have had lingering effects doing that. You certainly might have romantic effects if you took 3 teaspoons of oil a day.
So you went exploring in Titusville, Pennsylvania.
Beautiful Titusville, Pennsylvania, which is a very interesting
deer hunting country.
Deer hunting country, but remarkable history. The first oil boom and the remains of that are still there. They're hidden. The forest is regrown, but you can see things that are restored as part of a museum-type effort, but you can also wander through the woods and stumble across pipelines. And in those days, they laid pipelines on the ground. They didn't bury them. They're just laying on the ground. You can find the remains of old wells. You can find tools. You can find oil tanks made from wood, so they were pumping oil out of the ground, or sometimes it was flowing out of the ground under its own pressure, and they would store it in wooden tanks, basically big barrels that they custom made out in what's now forest, and stored the oil in those barrels until they could offload it into smaller barrels and into horse-drawn wagons and eventually down to the river and on off to market.
Oh, yeah, that's one thing I couldn't, being as how I come from that part of the country, I noticed that, you know the Allegheny River joins with the Monongahela to form the Ohio and then the Mississippi.
Right.
So it's going to go to the Gulf of Mexico, and yet the oil was being shipped from, I think, Philadelphia, which would be the Delaware River drainage, so it would have had to go across Pennsylvania or New York State somehow.
Well, you know, they had a remarkable canal systems, and I don't know exactly how they would have gotten it to Philadelphia at that time, but that was a shipping port that they were sending some of the oil out from Philadelphia, and some of it was marketed locally.
I mean, and they would actually ship this in barrels, actual barrels.
They had barrel shortages because they used up barrels quicker than people could manufacture the barrels, and they were shipping it in all kinds and shapes and sizes of barrels.
So did they? Was it originally a refined product, or would they just send the whole?
well, you know, they learned pretty quickly. So they got this rock oil out of the ground, and they were going to market
rock
it as
oil. They called it rock oil.
Rock oil, petroleum rock oil, and that's what they called it back then.
They thought it came out of coal originally, right? I mean, because they used to call kerosene. I remember when I was a kid, you go to the hardware store to buy your kerosene for your kerosene lantern.
Coal oil.
And they called it coal oil.
That's right. Yeah, sure. Sure. So there were a lot of theories about where rock oil came from, and some people called it the drippings from coal, and other people thought it had a volcanic origin, and it took a while for people to work out where it came from. But they didn't have a true market for it when they first started to develop it. They thought, well, we can probably make a fuel for lamps out of this. And, of course, that was at a time when whales had been hunted nearly to extinction mostly for lamp oil, not entirely for lamp oil, but mostly for lamp oil. And lamp oil was becoming very expensive, and people were switching to cheaper kinds of fuels and experimenting with different things. So these investors hired a person named Colonel Drake, Edwin Drake, sent him out to the wilds of Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania, told him drill for this oil, and he drilled, and he struck oil at, I believe it was I think it was around 69 feet, something like that. So Whoa. Not very deep. And
yeah, you can get a water well deeper than that.
Well, that's right. And we say drilled. Actually, they chiseled. Back in those days, the drilling was a percussion drilling, so they just kind of chiseled down.
So that's why they had that tall thing was basically just to pound something into the ground.
Well, they would lift it and drop it, lift it and drop it, lift it and drop it, lift it and drop it. In fact, some of the guys, once they realized they could make money from oil, some of the local farmers didn't have the capital to build a derrick, and they would just take a tree, and then they would take another tree or stick and make a fulcrum, and they would find this sort of a spring pole chisel drilling mechanism, and they found a lot of oil that way. Very shallow deposits.
What would this would go into some receptacle of some sort, and they'd sell it someplace.
That's right, and sometimes they would strike oil in a big way, and most of it would just flow away into the rivers and be lost. Basically, blowouts, we would call them today, but it was a common event back in those days. So they would get this oil out. They didn't have very good lamps for it, and you know this rock oil or crude oil had the unfortunate component in it of gasoline. And the gasoline, if you put it into these lamps with gasoline in it, they would have a bad tendency to explode. So they had to refine the product. But back in those days, refining the product meant you would boil off the light ends. You'd boil off the gasoline, get it down to something closer to kerosene, and then you would sell this this product as a lamp oil that was, you know, essentially a kerosene.
There's some kind of colossal metaphor there.
Yeah.
You know, that's really something.
Yeah, and then it took a while.
I can't get my head around it even now.
Well, and it took a while for the internal combustion engine to come along, and all of a sudden, you know, we had diesel engines and the regular engines that we use today. So there was a demand for gasoline, and the whole market sort of shifted. So before that, you were trying to sell product that was scrubbed clear of gasoline, and you were throwing the gasoline away. You're either boiling it away and letting the vapors go, or you were running it off into rivers, just throwing it away. And all of a sudden, there's a market for gasoline, and the advertising scheme shifted, and refining practices shifted to emphasize gasoline.
The cover of the book shows some bare feet on hot coals with flames around them. I hesitate to ask, but...
Go ahead. Everybody asks that. Go ahead.
Are they your feet?
My feet are not nearly that attractive. Those are someone else's feet.
I'm not. That doesn't surprise me.
Those are someone else's feet, but I did firewalk in the book, and in some ways... firewalking kept me going in this book, because when I started the research for heat, I thought to myself, well, you know, like everybody, I've heard of firewalking, and I thought, there must be a gimmick to it, and it can't be something you can just go out to do. Actually, it turns out there really is no true gimmick. There's no trick. You do walk barefoot across these hot coals with flames, and the coals are hot, and there are flames. But it also turns out that you can do it. It turns out that there's organizations out there that do organize firewalks for corporate team builders. So a corporation like for example, a public radio station could do a team builder.
Alaska Public Media Firewalk.
That's it.
We could do it along with our summer concert out here in the backyard on Mosquito Lake.
I'm thinking part of your annual fundraising effort, right? How many people are willing to donate how much to get Steve Heimel to walk across the fire again?
I'd do it for nothing.
And you would, because it's really an amazing experience. You know, and the other way people do it, and the way I did it, was through a person who runs firewalks for personal enrichment or personal empowerment.
You did want some kind of guide or something. You didn't just go out and take a cord of wood and waste it to.
Yeah, I think that would be a step past the Curious George to throwing all caution to the wind to do it on your own. There are, like, the kind of wood you want to use is part of it, and there's no trick to it, but there is a technique. You don't want to stomp on the coals when you're walking across. You don't want to run. You don't want to stand. You want to take a nice, a nice measured stride.
Is that a glide?
You probably don't want to glide.
You don't want to glide.
You don't want to shuffle. You don't want to shuffle your feet and get hot coals between your toes. That wouldn't be comfortable.
No, you wouldn't want to get something stuck in there.
No, that's right. I mean, that's probably how most people that get burned. It's mostly because they're getting a hot ember caught between their toes.
Well, you've got a quote from some corporate executive saying, but it was worth it.
That's right.
There was I got burned, but it was worth it.
That's exactly right. And that's how I felt, too. I felt like, well, if I do get burned, and I did actually get a little bit of blistering, but nothing too bad. And I thought, what's the big deal? You know, it goes away.
I can't believe you're even saying this. What the hell's the matter with you?
So you yourself just said you would do it, too. And I think your listeners are going to hold you to that, of course.
We'll see. Could be one of those legendary disc jockey stunts.
It would be
Harry Houdini knew how to pull those things.
It would be great. You'd have the sounds of the flame and the fire, and then the sounds of your feet crunching across the
Now we're getting something started, and, I can see it right now. 1-800-478-8255 to join this weird conversation with Bill Strever, author of Heat Has Talk of Alaska, continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Crowley, committed to Alaska for nearly 60 years. From basketball games to sled dog races, Crowley supports events that bring Alaskans together. Crowley supports what matters, and public radio matters. CPDAlaska.com. The University of Alaska Anchorage, the ultimate cross-trainer for finding your place in the world. Home to stellar academic programs and an exciting campus energy with all of the thrills you'll only find outside of an office or classroom. The University of Alaska Anchorage. Amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The telephone number to join our conversation on Talk of Alaska today with Bill Strever. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Bill Strever is author of Cold and now author of Heat, which is what we're talking about today. And we've been firewalking. We've been out on the volcano. We went to a nuclear collider of some sort.
Super collider.
Yeah, yep. Super collider to extremely hot temperatures, hotter than in the sun, right?
Yes, much hotter than in the sun.
Can't picture that. We went out to the oil fields, and I didn't mention, of course, that while he's there, at all these streams that were polluted by all this oil, as they discovered the uses for crude oil, what would Bill Strever do but put a canoe in there?
Well, that's right. If there's a river and there's a canoe around, I'm pretty likely to put the two together. But I wanted to follow the track of the oil, at least from some of the reservoirs. And the oil's near the Drake. The oil near the Drake well is on a creek called Oil Creek. And Oil Creek sometimes has enough water to float a canoe, and other times doesn't. When I was there, it was too low to float a canoe.
Too bony.
So I went to another nearby river that was also the site of lots of oil development. And paddled down that river and saw some remains of the old oil works from 100 years ago, but mostly it was gone and invisible. Occasionally you'd see pipes laying on the bottom, which was interesting, but most of it was gone.
The Allegheny River, right above the Allegheny.
The Allegheny and its tributaries, that's right, yeah.
You know, that's interesting and maybe a little bit heartening to hear about that recovery. Of course, it was a long time ago.
It was,
but nonetheless, you just wouldn't know that there was all these oil spills up there.
A casual observer wouldn't know, but the ground is contaminated. I'm sure some of their water is contaminated. The forest grows back, and, you know, ecosystems are resilient to a point, but it'll be a while before all signs of the degradation that occurred there goes away.
Interesting. Probably nobody's measuring anything there.
I think the state of Pennsylvania is keeping a close eye on that.
They're not keeping a very good eye on fracking, let me tell you that. You know, that area has had boom and bust, boom and bust, boom and bust, you know, because I come from there. And they had the oil boom, yeah. but they had a natural gas boom as well.
Sure.
They had a timber boom,
yeah.
And they're having, I think, the third natural gas boom now.
Well, and before they had an oil boom, there was already a timber boom in place. So when Colonel Drake went there to drill for oil, who was there in this little area where he was? It was essentially wilderness loggers. It was a logging community. Yeah.
Do you feel like, you know, I noticed, you know, and it's one of the reasons why I ask you, is you have massive, copious notes in here, which, you know, as a talk radio person, a researcher and so forth, I really appreciate that. But do you feel like, you know, if you didn't have some editor cracking the whip on you, that this could be three times as long as it is.
Well, it'd be more myself cracking the whip on myself. I think people only have so much time for books these days, and unless you're writing a novel, that's sort
of a distraction. But this one's episodic. I mean, you put this down for a month and pick it back up, and you still be okay.
Well, and that's by intent, for sure. Uh-huh. Put it down for a month, put it down for a minute, pick it up, start reading.
Put it in the outhouse.
You could put it in the outhouse, and I think I've heard people say they've done that with
really?
At least one of these books.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but you got the paper in there, too,
yeah,
when you're
right.
done.
That's right. That's
that's better than that Sears Roebuck paper, too.
That's a compliment. That's a compliment every author lives for right there.
How could you ever leave Alaska? I mean, you know, there's no other place in the country where, you know, you can get away with talk like that.
Yeah. And I don't think I'll ever completely leave Alaska. That's definitely not on a map.
Well, you have done so much research, and you know, in your profession, you're an educated man. You deal with technical things. What is your education? Would you say you are self-educated in these things that you're researching, all this history and so forth, or does this come out of organized, structured educational background?
Well, I've got a twisted path. So I started out as a young man working in oil fields. I was a commercial diver in oil fields for a long time before I eventually got around to going to college, and I went to college, University of Florida, so sort of a hot area in Florida, hot and humid in the swamps there in Gainesville. And I did a degree in biology.
Some wonderful people on the faculty there, though.
Oh, yeah. It's a great university. Yeah. And I did a bachelor's degree in zoology, so animal biology, and then immediately went into a graduate program on applied ecology, environmental engineering applied ecology, and mostly working on wetlands. And from there, moved into broader studies of wildlife and habitat, and I still do quite a bit of work on habitat restoration. And but in terms of things like heat and cold, a lot of it's physics, so a lot of that was, I won't call it self-education, because I relied on the goodwill of lots of highly trained physicists, and in some cases chemists and various other kinds of scientists, who were perfectly willing to put their time into helping me understand what they were working on. So it wasn't a formal training, but it certainly wasn't self-educated. I didn't go out and do all these experiments myself, and of course I read thousands and thousands of pages about these topics, and some of these pages were stuff that was written.
Well, yeah, some
in
of this
1700s.
Is pretty arcane. I mm-hmm. mean, you know, yeah. digging up those advertisements for that patent medicine made from crude oil, for instance.
And they're surprisingly hard to find in this day of the world.
Well, I mean, a lot of that stuff is sitting in, like, weird little libraries, local libraries, historical societies, and all that sort of thing. And
that's
it's
right.
not
yeah.
ordinary research. You know?
That's right. I stumble across stuff, and sometimes I'll make notes about things, thinking, oh, I might use this 10 years from now somewhere, and I'll jot it down in a notebook, and then maybe I'll remember it later and go back and find it. And that, you know, you mentioned the notes in the back of the book, and a lot of reviewers have also mentioned the notes, because my notes are a combination of sort of, here's my reference, here's where I found this information, but also some of the notes are additional stories that didn't make it into the book that I thought were too nice to leave behind. So they make it into the back of the book, and a number of reviewers have said, you know, read the notes as well as the book. They're worth reading. And I would say they're worth scanning, at least.
How many years between heat and cold?
I think about three, I think.
So that's an awful lot of travel in 3 years.
Yes. Yeah. I travel a lot. I'm trying to reduce my travel and until we move on to our boat, and then we'll be traveling under sail.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But you're traveling, you know, as you say, you look for the angle of the book wherever you are.
Mm-hmm. kind of
but at the same time, you had goals. I mean, firewalking was a goal.
Well, so some of it I definitely traveled specifically for the book. So firewalking, I did my firewalk in Northern California or Central California, and that was a specific trip that I made for the book. And going to Titusville, I didn't have any business whatsoever in Titusville other than the book.
People rarely do.
People rarely do, exactly. But it's a charming little town. It really is. I mean, it's this post-industrial town, and someone's turned several railroad cars into a hotel, so you can stay in these old railroad cars that must be 50 years old or older. Yeah. And Oil Creek is a very picturesque little creek, and the Oil Well Museum is fantastic.
I have... so many different directions to go. but I'm back to those little regional museums and repositories. You're a lot of this is in the United States, although you do go to other countries. But it just has always struck me as a traveler, what a wonderful country we live in, because there's history wherever you go. You're going to find this whole heritage you didn't know about. That's absolutely fascinating. The deeper you go into it, the more you find out. And then after a while, and what I discover in reading your book and what I wanted to ask you about is that your research starts coming back together. In other words, years ago, a friend of mine was researching a family tree and she discovered it was a wreath. And my mother's into genealogy, and she says, well, that's almost always happens. but you look deep enough into things, and after a while, they start coming together on the other end. Do you know what I mean?
I do. Things are interconnected, and I think of what I've done with heat and cold. I think of the style as kind of a braided storyline, and it's because of all these stories coming together.
Well, then you find these synchronicities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes they're research, but sometimes it seems like it just sort of popped together like that.
That is the nature of the world, as you're pointing out. I mean, if you travel, you pretty quickly find out that this thing that happened over here that you'd never heard of before is only two steps away from this thing over here that you know an awful lot about because it's got a direct connection somehow to your life.
Wow. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, the number's 550-8422. Bill Strever is here in the studio with us to talk to you about his book, Heat, which can be difficult if you haven't read it yet. It's only been out a little bit, right?
It's only been out about 8 weeks now, I think.
So let's say people can call up and ask you about cold as well.
They can call. They can ask about cold.
And
they
that's
can
out
call
in paperback now.
That's out in paperback, and both books are out in electronic format as well. Yeah. And I'm always happy to hear and excited to hear other people's stories about cold and heat because I surely don't I don't have the last word on these subjects just because I wrote a book.
No. None of us have got the last word. So do you have quite the library at home at this point?
I do. I'm trying to shrink my library.
Yes, but, you are, aren't you? You mentioned that.
That's right. But my electronic library keeps growing, and I'm a big fan of electronic books because I can take my library with me when I go places. It does make the local bookstores suffer, and I think that's a shame. We're seeing a demise in bookstores, which are sort of a commercially operated facet of our culture that we're losing because of the electronic publishing and big organizations like Amazon, obviously, and that's a tragedy. But some things we haven't talked about that are in heat, forest fires are interesting to people. Human use of fire, that's interesting. Nuclear weapons and thermonuclear weapons are always interesting, especially.
I didn't even want to get started on that.
you should have told me before the show.
No, it's okay. It's fine. I'm glad to go there. Now that you have, we better.
Okay.
You go all the way out to Amchica, and with Dr. Teller, and you made a point of going to the Project Chariot site.
Yes.
I don't recall you did anything too dangerous there.
I guess it would depend on your standard. We did walk for 70 miles through the bush, which, you know, to most Alaskans would be kind of second nature, but people on the East Coast that read this book, I think they think that's probably crazier than firewalking.
Well, yeah, and there were animals.
There are animals. There are animals around there.
You didn't carry a gun.
Well, no, we did carry a shotgun on that trip. I hardly ever do that. And the reason we did it on that trip is that this might get some callers calling in a controversial topic. I normally use pepper spray, but you can't take pepper spray on these small planes.
Right.
Yeah, we took a small plane out to Point Hope. We could take a shotgun on the plane, but we couldn't take pepper spray. We took a shotgun.
So that I didn't really realize that you could negotiate. Do you have to wait for low tide or anything? Get around those bluffs there?
No, you turn inland. I don't think you can get around the bluffs even at low tide. You turn inland, so it's a walk along the beach for a few days, and then you turn inland and swing back, and then you actually approach the Cape Thompson or the Chariot site from inland along the creek.
All right. It occurs to me that 80% of our listeners are not going to know what we're talking about, so I think we'll just take a break and then retrench and do a little bit of the background about Project Chariot and the nuclear industry in Alaska.
Excellent.
As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The University of Alaska Anchorage, where a freshman computer science course sparked a six-figure career in digital game design. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Alaska would not be the same without Project Chariot, and that's one of the things that Bill Strever, author of Heat, writes about in his book. Project Chariot was something that essentially politicized Alaska Natives, among other things, because it was the notion of creating a harbor where actually it'd be really nice to have a harbor up there someplace around Kivalina.
Yeah, preferably not a radioactive harbor, but
preferably nice not radioactive. But yeah. That was the idea, to blow up an H-bomb up there.
That's right, and that grew out of, and there's a great story. The entire story has been told in lots of detail by, I think it's Dan O'Neill, in a book called Firecracker Boys. It's well known to many Alaskans. But, you know, we World War II, we invented the atomic bombs, and very quickly after that, in a very short period of time, invented the hydrogen bomb, and Edward Teller was one of the people that invented that, and then was disappointed as we went into to test ban treaties. But then he was delighted when Eisenhower came along and said, gave his Adams for Peace speech. And he said, we can use this great destructive power, we can harness it for civilian projects. And the Russians were doing the same thing. And in the States, we never really got off the ground with this stuff. So Teller had come up with a scheme to dig a harbor in Alaska, but it never got off the ground. He was shut down by the environmental movement and by the native community of Point Hope and elsewhere. But in Russia, there was a very active program. They did everything from digging canals they put out oil or gas well fires. They had some gas well fires that they couldn't extinguish. So what a great use for an atomic bomb. They put them out with an atomic bomb. They shot a seismic transect, of all things. They shot a seismic transect across Russia using atom bombs as the source, just the way today we use air guns in the offshore environment, or we use vibrating trucks for onshore seismic. They needed a sound source to put sound into the ground. What better way to generate sound than an atom bomb?
So,
or what worse?
Where's the heat?
Where's the heat?
Where's the heat?
Where's the heat in that story? Well, yeah. The heat, of course, is if you set off an atom bomb, it generates a tremendous amount of heat, and a hydrogen bomb even more so. So the hydrogen bomb, the reaction that's going on is exactly the same reaction that occurs in the core of the sun. It occurs much more on a larger scale in the core of the sun, but it's the same reaction. It generates that heat, and then that heat in the sun finds its way to the surface. By the time it's at the surface of the sun, it's considerably cooler. But on the inside of the sun, it's in the tens of millions of degrees, 24 million degrees and hotter.
Yeah, this one's always bothered me because, I went to listen to Dr. Teller, one of his, probably his last trip to Alaska, and he was still, you know, carrying on about why we needed to have X-ray lasers was his big thing, then his X-ray laser powered by nuclear explosions.
Yeah.
This is how we're going to explore space. But I mean, people got him talking about the Project Chariot, and he was totally unrepentant. And
he was a very strong-willed man and remarkably intelligent.
Well, when you read the history, you know, as in the Firecracker Boys and elsewhere, you discover that Howard Hughes was not wanting to have explosions in the desert because it shook his hotel room in Las Vegas. And so Nixon let them blow up Amchitka instead. It's the damnedest thing. And that was an immense explosion. The third one.
Yeah, there were some big bomb tests in Amchitka, but nothing like the quantity of bomb tests that occurred in the desert down near Las Vegas. And while Howard Hughes may have found it inconvenient, lots of people found it entertaining, and they would host parties, and they would sit on their balconies and watch for the flash, and they would have atomic drinks, as they would call them, and you know, all these stories that go along with the nuclear testing. And that was another site that I visited for the book, was the nuclear testing grounds, which was really a fascinating trip. It's available to the public, I think, once a month. You have to book way in advance. They do a quick security check. No cameras, but they do take you out onto the site, and you can see hundreds of bomb test sites, and many of them craters where they did underground tests that lead to cratering. So they set a bomb off underground, and that vaporizes a void underground.
Did you carry a Geiger counter with you when you were doing this?
No, you know, I wanted to, but I don't think you'd get away with it. I don't think they don't want people snooping around too closely. There's still a feeling that there's military secrets there, I suppose. I can't imagine what. It does seem like a distant past, but it's quite a place to visit and quite an experience. And the tour guide, at least the tour guide that was with us, was a person that had worked on site through the blast, and he had lots of stories to share about that experience.
Well, we got an email here from Phil in Anchorage to say he really enjoyed Cold. He was very excited to read Heat. He's sure he'll enjoy it just as much as first book. But he didn't feel he needed to come on radio to say that.
Well,
send an email.
Very nice of him to send the email. Thanks.
1-800-478-8255. If you want to send an attaboy to Bill Strever. I called Cold a bestseller, and I guess it kind of was.
It was a bestseller. I think it made the New York Times list for a short time. It wasn't one of these books that stayed on the list and made to the top of the list, but it found its way onto the bestseller list and also the indie bestseller list and was a national bestseller.
Did you know from the beginning that this is the type of writing that you wanted to do? I mean, you could tell right away you have a bent for science, but you've added the personal narrative and the personal experimentation and then quite a lot of history, natural history as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, my writing, I think like all writers, I've evolved over time. But as a boy, I was very fond, and still am very fond, of John McPhee, who isn't, right? And I thought, well, that's an interesting style. And I was very fond of books like Moby Dick as well, that kind of wove these narratives of personal experience and some thought in literature and history. And I thought, well, I would like to do that. And I write lots of technical papers as a biologist. And technical writing, it's important, it's very useful, but it's not a lot of fun. So I wanted in my off time to be writing in a way that was more enjoyable to me, and that's how I landed on the style of Cold and Heat. And there were some other books prior to these that were not at all successful. But one of the things that I learned from those books, and they were what academics might call crossover books, where you're writing through an academic press, but you're trying to capture an audience of non-specialists. And what I learned from those books, because they were so unsuccessful, what I learned from them was take some freedom. And when I was writing Cold, I said, take some freedom, let yourself go a little bit, because, you know, you're not going to write a bestseller no matter what you do. That's clear from your past books. I gave myself that freedom, let the leash out a little bit, and surprisingly to me, Cold did turn into a bestseller.
So you were following your curiosity, basically.
I was following my curiosity. And I you know, early on in the show today, you were talking about the persona that's kind of projected by the book. And I often, when I think of my books, I often think little vision in my head is Curious George. You remember Curious George books?
Oh, yeah, you brought that up before. Yeah, yeah, Curious George sticking the hammer into the lava.
He's always doing something and getting himself into trouble.
always something.
Always something, yeah. And that's sort of the person I am, and I like to think
of. Are you that way as a biologist, too?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think most scientists are.
Oh, come on. I got to have an example now.
Well, you know, I think most scientists are at one level or another. Right?
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, why would you become a scientist if you weren't driven by curiosity? And, you know, Curious George did things that caused trouble. Scientists do things that completely take over their lives, right? Mm. They build multi-billion-dollar super colliders outside of New York City in order to understand what happens when you throw two gold ions into one another at the speed of light. You know, scientists do mad stuff.
And often it is really, at the bottom of it, isn't this just the coolest damn thing?
it is, you know, and that was another thing that sort of driven my writing. Inspired would probably be the wrong word, but driven my writing is that I see scientists out there doing the coolest stuff, the most interesting stuff, and then we write it up and we're trained, it's beaten into us when we write it up to write in a certain format that takes this really fascinating stuff we're doing and makes it god-awful boring. Unless you're one of the 15 specialists.
Carl Sagan,
Well, but Sagan, when he's writing his stuff for popular audiences, he's not, you know, I'm sure his technical papers are written in another style.
Yeah.
So I wanted to write books that that took science, turned it into a story, and then wove that story into everyday life as well.
This is just the coolest thing.
That's right. That's right.
Well,
the coolest, hottest thing.
Let me throw this one in. I didn't think I'd have time for it, but here I am with a question about science and science education, because I think we're kind of lacking in this country right now. We're kind of, these are science books. You need a little background to appreciate what you're writing about here. And I'm just wondering if we're losing some of our money for what you would call non-applied research.
Well, I think we're certainly losing funding. The government, society has to make tough choices right now. I think we're finally starting to realize that we don't have an unlimited supply of money. And, I spent some time thinking about the tragedy of funding cuts to science, and particularly to unapplied science. And then I think to myself, well, something has to be cut. Where would you cut? And it's actually pretty hard to think of the things we should be cutting out in society. So I'm glad I'm not an elected official having to deal with that. But no doubt science is being cut. The super collider that we've mentioned several times in New York in particular is suffering from cuts. And why is that? It's because there's a new super collider in Europe, and it's a bigger super collider. So people that don't really understand the way that kind of science works, they're saying, well, the super collider in Europe is going to do all the work. But the fact is that there's only so much time. All of these experiments take a long time. And there's still plenty of room for the collider in Brookhaven to do good work if it can get sustained funding.
Judy in Fairbanks, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Bill Strever. Only got about a minute.
Yeah, just wanted to tell Bill I enjoyed the cold book very much. I'm looking forward to the one on heat. And what I especially enjoyed is just like listening to you guys talk is that it's sort of eclectic way of approaching the world, and it involves all the different fields of study, and it makes it into one world, and that's what I think is so interesting, and I really like his books. Thanks.
All right.
Well, thank you, and I'm going to use that later when I talk to people about the book. It makes it into one world, and that's definitely one of the things I'm trying to do.
That's the thing with these authors. They'll steal you blind.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for being with us. I look forward to your next appearance on Talk of Alaska, Bill Strever.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks to our tech crew, Josh Edge, Dave Waldron. Next week's subject is Alaska's natural gas. Larry Persily will be joining us on the show, and we'll just try and work through, man. I mean, an hour will not be enough, but that's how it goes. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.